When the Apostle Paul gathered a group of new Christian followers, he held high hopes that they would embody Jesus' teachings of selfless love, moral purity, and human harmony. In reality, the Corinthians blew it, big time. Paul responded with a corrective plan to help God's people experience life together as God intended. Come join us as we study Paul's timeless instructions for living, loving, and working as a team to realize change in ourselves and our community in a series called Life Together.
Hey, good morning, everyone. How you doing? You good? Oh, you're rowdy. Wow. Calm down, everyone. It's church. And behave yourselves, man. My name's John. I'm one of the pastors here. I know we got a bunch of guests when people are being baptized and dedicated, so I want to make sure to introduce myself to you. If you've been here, we've been talking about life together, what it looks like to be the church, kind of how that plays out, what we're supposed to expect from each other, what we're supposed to be doing for each other, and really what does it look like to live life together. And on the third week, I want to talk about a really important aspect of that, and that's that we take care of our marriages. Part of doing life together means we take care of our marriages. We care for each other in that way. Now, the last time that I talked about racial reconciliation, and it was a really tense message. It was heavy, and so I was like, all right, this is good. My next one's going to be like a softball, you know, marriage, that's easy. That's a good one. I can do that. But that was my fault because I hadn't really read 1 Corinthians 7 in a while, and so I opened that up being like, all right, marriage, what are we going to, and I was like, this whole passage is about sex. This isn't about marriage. That's not a softball. And so, now, some of you guys don't know the difference between marriage and sex, and stick around, we're going to talk about some of that, maybe help you out a little bit, but I need to give you a couple disclaimers, and it looks like we're doing pretty well kid-wise. We're going to talk about marriage and sex, and so I checked with all of our teachers. We have wonderful environments for the kids. They aren't talking about that today, and so if you would be more comfortable taking your child there, I will not be offended. You can go check them in and do that. They'll probably have a great time. The other disclaimer is that I'm very committed to preaching consistently out of one version of the Bible. Usually here we use the NIV. That's almost what I always use. But for this message, I'm going to bounce back and forth between the contemporary English version and the NIV. It softens some of the hard edges here and will make it a little more palatable in this big crowd. So if you want to read both later, you can see I'm not ducking anything. I'm not hiding behind anything. I'm just trying to make the language as easy to take as possible. But I think it's really important that we talk about this. I really do. One, I think it's important because it's in the Bible. We've gone through the first six chapters of 1 Corinthians, which leads us to the seventh chapter, and this is what the topic is about. But also because of what our main point is this morning, and that's that doing life together means protecting and cultivating strong marriages. I think this is a really important part of doing life together because in order for us to have a strong and healthy community here, we have to place a priority on caring for our marriages. And it's really important because I believe that marriage is the greatest and most challenging of all relationships. But also when we say that, that's only half the equation because I also strongly believe that marriage has the potential to be the most rewarding and fulfilling relationship that you can have. I know that marriage does not have to go flat. It doesn't have to grow sour or bitter or worse with time. Marriage can be absolutely wonderful. But I can tell you this, you won't just look up one day and say, would you look at that? Well, that's great. We have a great marriage. How did that happen? Who knew? We ended up with a great marriage. It's committed. Everything's good. That's so cool. You may very well have that someday, and some of you may have that now. But it will be because you submitted to God, and you did things His way in the relationship. It will be because you put in the hard work of being married. Because Paul, the author of the books of Corinthians, he wasn't married, but even he knew that marriage was hard. Look at 1 Corinthians 7:28. This is a little after the passage we're going to focus on today. He says, it isn't wrong to marry, even if you've never been married before, but those who marry will have a lot of trouble, and I want to protect you from this. Now, I've had a lot of people ask me to use 1 Corinthians 13 in their wedding. No one's ever asked me to use 1 Corinthians 7:28. Like, dearly beloved, it's really hard to be married, and I want to protect you from this. Like, no one's ever asked for that. No one's ever wanted me to put that in there. But that's Paul, man. Paul, he doesn't pull any punches. He gives it to you straight. I've spent some time thinking about what I want my daughters to know about dating and relationships and marriage. And my daughters are 8 and 5, and she'd really like the half, 5 and a half. And the youngest one's 3 and a half, but she doesn't care if you use the half or not. And mostly what I want them to know about relationships is that they're not old enough to have them. And they won't be for like 20 years. That's important. But when they get to be 25, I want them to know that God created relationships. He created relationships, and so following his process for relationships will lead to the most rewarding and fruitful relationships possible. Now, my wife Amy and I, we have a fantastic marriage, and I don't say that lightly, I mean it humbly, but I think that's important to say because it's not by chance, and it's not by accident. Most of it is because Amy is incredibly patient and gracious, as you can imagine it would take to be married to me. But also a lot of it is because we work at it. We really deliberately work on being married. We always are trying to improve. We're trying to get better. We're trying to be better. We're trying to communicate more, trying to communicate more effectively. I found out a while ago that her love language is words of affirmation. And so I like to do acts of service. I'm doing acts of service all the time, and it's like spinning wheels. But then I realized on her birthday a while ago, instead of buying one card because I'm cheap, one card for like $5, I bought a pack of 10 cards for like $3.99. And I wrote one of them for her birthday, and I said, and as part of this, you're getting the next 9 over the course of the year so that I remembered to write her notes because that is a really important thing. But I always want to get better. I don't want to just be like, well, this is who I am, and you're stuck with it. So if you're married, or if you're ever going to be married in the future, that's what I want for you, is a commitment to work on your marriage. I hope, and I've been praying leading up to this message, that each married couple would take away at least one thing that they're going to very deliberately work on together. Because we have people all over the relational map this morning. We have people that are single, and we have people that are single again, people that are dating, people that are happily married, people that are not so happily married. We have people with marriages that are just hanging on by a thread this morning. But I believe that God has something to say to each of us this morning about our relationships. So Paul, in his first letter to the church in Corinth, he gets to chapter 7. We've gone through the first 6 chapters in the first 2 weeks of this series. He gets to chapter 7, and he turns to some questions that the people had asked. And he starts with a question about marriage. And this was really important because there was this word going around that it was best to just be single. If you really wanted to live the Christian life well, be single. Now think about it. Paul was single. John the Baptist was single. Jesus was single. So they're looking around and being like, apparently, the way to be a good Christian is to be single. And Paul addresses this right in the beginning of chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. Here's what he tells us. I will answer the questions you asked in your letter. You asked, is it best for people not to marry? Well, having your own husband or wife should keep you from doing something immoral. All right, Paul. So Paul's coming right out, man. He's just going to be right up front about this and tell you that sex is exclusively designed for the context of marriage. It's really important. Sex is exclusively intended for the context of marriage. Physical intimacy is the reward of marriage. The physical commitment should only come after the emotional and relational commitment that also comes with being married. But it's not just like a rule that you should follow so you can be holy. It will actually have huge benefits in your relationship if you're serious about doing things the way that God asks us to do them. And some of you don't like that. Some of you hate that. It gets so quiet when I bring this up because you think that that means a big controlling God just wants to squash all your fun, just wants you to keep from doing what you really want to do. But it's really interesting. Think about this. It's interesting to resent the Creator for wanting us to show or wanting to show us how to use something the right way. It's very interesting because if I was going to go to Home Depot and buy a table saw, and I won't because that's a really bad idea on a lot of levels. But if I was, I hire people that own table saws. That's the way to do it. If I was, it would come with all sorts of disclaimers and instructions and safety features. And there would be guards and there would be all this stuff where they would say, hey, here's the right way to use a table saw and here are some wrong ways to use a table saw. And if that happened, none of us would look at that table saw and be like, whatever, craftsman, you jerks. Like, you don't run my life. You just want to stop me from really enjoying this table saw. We would never do that with craftsmen. May I suggest that similarly to how the makers of the table saw have some very good insight on how to best use it and also how to best not use it, that the Creator of people, the creator of relationships, and yes, the creator of sex, has a lot to offer us in the way of wisdom about how to use those things and how they should be properly handled. And over, time and time again, the Bible clearly tells us that sex was designed exclusively for marriage. I mean, think for a second about how many societal problems would be immediately eliminated if there was only sex within the context of marriage. Well, here, Paul says, one of the benefits of being married is so that you can have that physical relationship. Then he goes on in the next two verses to clarify some things about that in 3 and 4. He tells us, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. And that's because marriage is designed to be a mutually submissive relationship. That was the design of marriage. Now, obviously, he's speaking here in the context of the physical relationship, and that's true, and that's important. He's going to tell us more about why that's so important in the next verse. But I also think it's really important to grasp this outside of just the context of the physical relationship, to understand that marriage was not designed to have one person as the boss and the other person as the subordinate. It could just as easily have been said, the wife does not have authority over her own life, but yields it to her husband. And in the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own life, but yields it to his wife. Because a marriage is never going to be fully functional if one person does whatever they want to and the other person becomes a doormat. I always have this red flag if I'm, you know, going through and doing pre-marriage counseling with couples, or maybe I'm talking to them after they're married and they say, oh, we never have any disagreements. I will always ask, who's the doormat? Because there are disagreements, just one person is never bringing them up because they got sick of getting bulldozed, so they stopped. Marriage was made to be equal, and it works the best when it is that way. A marriage with unequal power structure will always be prone to problems. There will always be some things that happen. Eventually, doormats get resentful, and they get sick of doing that, and they fight back. They get sick of being treated like a second-class citizen. So instead of just taking turns of who gets to be in charge today, instead of saying, well, you know, today's my day and tomorrow's your day, or instead of doing it like a jump ball possession in basketball, to be like, well, you got the last call, honey, so this one's mine. How about this? Just strive to put the other person's needs in front of yours. Isn't that crazy? That's such a countercultural thing. Strive to put your spouse's needs in front of yours. That's actually what you signed up for when you got married. You may or may not have known that. That's what you were saying, is that I'm no longer number one. I'm putting them first. They come before me. And what's great is that you don't always have to be selfishly looking out for yourself when you have a spouse that is always looking out for you. When you have a spouse that you know will put you first. We had a great example of this in our marriage a couple years ago. It was 2013 because the Red Sox were really good and they won the World Series that year. I like to remind you of that whenever possible. So our anniversary is in October, and during the first playoff series, the ALDS, a playoff game fell on our anniversary. Now, I saw this coming and I had worked through it in my mind. I was like, okay, we're going out to dinner and a movie. I'm going to miss the game. I'm pretty sure I'll live, but it's going to be close. And Amy realized it like the day before. She's like, wait, isn't game 4 tomorrow night? And I was like, yeah. She's like, well, what do you have to watch that? And I was like, no, I'm going to miss the game. You know, we're going to keep our plans and it's fine. It's going to be good. She's like, no, you can't miss the game. Are you kidding? You've never missed a playoff game in your life. You have to watch this game. And I was like, listen, I'm not watching that game, all right? You're not going to make me watch the game. We're going out to dinner and a movie and we're going to enjoy it. And I had good reasons for it. So I did not watch the game. And the Red Sox did win because God rewarded my faithfulness for that and moved them on, and they won the World Series, probably all because I put my marriage first. But I remember, like, in that moment being like, my wife is arguing that I need to watch a playoff game on our anniversary, and I'm arguing that there's no way I'm going to. And in that moment, we were both putting each other first in a way that we didn't have to be selfish because someone else was being selfish on our behalf. So understand that marriage is designed to be a mutually submissive relationship. But returning to the physical side of things in verse 5, here's what he says about that. He tells us, do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This is really important. Your sex drive was intended by God to be a blessing, but Satan will try to turn it into a curse. That's how it was intended. It was intended to be a good thing, and we need to make sure that we understand this. We need to make sure that we're together on this front. Husbands and wives need to grasp this together. It's a really important thing because it will become a curse if you don't handle it the right way. Wives, I've told you this before, but it's important for you to hear it and consider the ramifications of it. You are the only healthy, biblical, acceptable answer for your husband's sex drive. Now, for some of you, you can feel a ton of pressure for that, and we'll keep unpacking that, but that's it. You are it. The Bible says this is a part of the marriage, and so when we have these times in our relationship where people are deprived, all of a sudden it creates complications. Now, husbands, I need to tell you this. This is important because I know how your mind's working right now. One, that does not mean you get to be a lazy jerk about that, okay? It does not mean sex on demand. It doesn't mean like, well, the pastor said, honey. Like, that's not, don't misquote me like that. That's not what I'm saying. What it probably does, it also does not mean, it's important, that if your wife isn't fulfilling your needs to the standard that you would like to have them fulfilled, that you get to go sleep around. Certainly does not mean that. It probably more likely means that you need to write her some love notes, or you need to do the dishes, or you need to take the kids to the park and let her take a nap in peace, something like that. Look into that. Because guys, it's really important when we say that, when I make sure that your wives know that they are the only healthy, biblically acceptable outlet for your sex drive, that you still know you have to do your best. You got to work hard for your wife's love and respect and be the kind of guy that she wants to be with. Learn her love language. If you don't know that, find that out. Make an effort. Crazy thing, do the same things once you're married that you did to get her to marry you. Because marriage is not the finish line of a relationship. Marriage is the starting block. And because here, Paul says what will happen otherwise is that the devil is going to use that drive to scheme to ruin your marriage. And of course he would. Fewer things have a bigger return on investment for Satan than a destroyed marriage. I mean, he can take generations and families and bring so much damage and destruction in just a couple minutes of stupid decision-making, because Satan will use that drive that God created that can be good, and he will turn it into a curse. And he's been doing it forever. He's been doing it for generations. It's a very successful play. He's not going to take it out of the playbook. He's going to keep running it because it's going so well for him. So we need to guard our hearts. We need to guard our lives. We need to work together to guard our marriages. And when I'm talking about this kind of thing, I always need to make sure that I mention this, because it's such a huge issue, and I push this big time with couples that I'm doing pre-marriage counseling for. Let your spouse see your phone and your computer. Do it. If you have an iPhone, you can put your spouse's fingerprint in there. Amy's is in mine. I have nothing to hide. Now, that does not mean that she doesn't trust me. That doesn't mean I don't think she trusts me. It just means I don't want any place to hide things in my marriage. I don't want any message that I'm getting that my wife can't see. I don't want any old Facebook high school girlfriends messaging me and then being like, oh man, no, my wife's going to see that if she wants to, and there's no place to hide that stuff. And whenever I have guys push back, maybe you're the exception. Anytime I've known particularly guys who have refused to do that, said, no, my privacy matters to me, that's not, if she trusts me, she doesn't need to see that. Every single time, it's turned out that guy's had a reason. Maybe you're the exception. I don't think you are. If you value your marriage, let it go. I don't want to hear about your privacy. The pastor said two became one. You are married. You can do this. Get over it. It's important. And if the three of us need to sit down and I can help talk you through it, I will let you know. It's incredibly important in your marriage. So do that. Maybe that's a change some of you need to make today. So he goes on in verses 6 and 7. Here's what Paul says. In my opinion, that is what should be done, though I don't know of anything the Lord said about this matter. I wish all of you were like me, but God has given different gifts to each of us. That's such a great Paul line. I wish you all were like me. I wish you all had my gifts, but you weak people, you have a bunch of different gifts that are not mine. So he goes on in verses 8 and 9, and here's what he tells us about his gifts. My advice for the unmarried and for the widows is that it is acceptable for them to remain single, just as I am. But if you don't have enough self-control, then go ahead and get married. That's another great verse here, right? All right, where's the married lack of self-control people? All right, good. Thanks for letting me be the only one to raise my hand. You guys are cool. After all, it's better to marry than to burn with desire. It's another verse no one's ever asked me to use in their wedding. But Paul, here's what Paul says. I'm going to put together a great marriage ceremony for somebody with these verses. Neither being married nor single is inherently superior to the other option. It's really important. There are various ways of living the Christian life. One of them is being married, another is being single, and one is not inherently better or worse than the other. They both have unique challenges and benefits. They have unique strengths that they bring to the church community, because neither being single nor being married is the ultimate goal for a Christian. And that's really where this whole passage got started with the question from the Corinthians was, will we be a better Christian if we are single? And Paul's saying, no, neither one is inherently superior. But sometimes in churches, we forget this. We go the other way, right? We forget, and churches become a place where it can be pretty hard for singles, where a lot of people are married, and you feel like, oh, I'm the only one here that's not. And John Acuff, who's a great author, he compiled a list of some of the things that presumably well-meaning married people like to say to single people at church. Things like, I just don't understand how somebody as great as you isn't married yet. You meant that as a compliment, I get that, but maybe don't keep saying that one. Married people love to tell single people, if you just stop looking for love, you'll find it. Like, that's really good advice that everybody's been given 100 times. Or when they introduce you, they have to give the disclaimer, like, this is my single friend, Matt. You know, they put that in there. Or this is also good. Some of you guys do this. When you introduce a single person, you also need to list their accomplishments. So you're like, this is Sally, my single friend who owns her own home, drives a very nice luxury car, and has a super stable job. Like, you have to give all those kind of things. Or instead of saying that somebody's single, your friends describe you as not married yet. And as a church and as individuals, we can be guilty of that. We can be guilty of trying to fix people. Sometimes we're trying to cure people of something they don't want to be cured of. Because this is really important. Being single is not necessarily indicative of some inherent brokenness. Just as we know at the same time, being married is not necessarily indicative of some inherent completeness or togetherness or having it all together. So single people, I want you to know, and here in the middle of this message all about marriage, that we appreciate you, and we appreciate where you are in your life. We don't want to try and fix you or cure you. We believe there are a ton of unique strengths and gifts that you bring to our church, and we're grateful that you're here. We're grateful that we're on this journey together, and we think there's a lot that we can both learn about relationships from each other. But then he continues in verse 10. He goes back to the married side. Here's what he says in 10 and 11. To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. Paul knew, even as a single guy, Paul knew that marriage requires endless commitment. He knew that's what it was going to take. Paul knew that marriage is hard work, that having two separate individuals come together to share a house, to share a room, to share a bed, to share goals and dreams, to share finances, that one gets kind of complicated sometimes, to share children, family relationships, mothers-in-law. He knew that that was complicated, and that's something that doesn't happen naturally. It doesn't happen easily. It's not something that happens without challenges. And if you're going to make it through those challenges, it is going to require an endless commitment, the kind of commitment that says, this is it. It's you and it's me forever. Now, some couples do that when they're engaged, and they say, all right, this is it. Some couples do that when they're newly married. Some couples do that farther down the road. But where you say, I don't think everything's going to be good. I know everything's not going to be easy. But what I do know is that it's you and it's me, and we're going to face this together. And you have that moment, and you say that to each other. Because if you make divorce an option, there will be times when divorce looks like a good option, or maybe even it looks like your best option. But if we decide together that no matter what comes our way, we are in this together, we can begin the endless commitment. Because while a lot of couples say to love and to cherish till death do us part, what they really meant when they said that was to love and to cherish as long as you meet my needs and fulfill my desires. But if you stop doing that, or I come across someone I think might be able to do that better than you, then I'm out. Now, sadly, I have to give a very necessary disclaimer here that if you are in a relationship that has involved abuse or infidelity, that this doesn't apply to you. I think the church has really done some damage in this area because we want to push the importance of commitment in marriage so much, and then we neglect to tell people that are being abused or being cheated on that their spouse has voided that contract. Your commitment to marriage does not involve somebody abusing you. It does not. And any of the pastors here would be honored to help you navigate that, to get you to a safer and healthier situation. But don't ever let somebody, a pastor or somebody else, tell you that exiting an abusive or unfaithful relationship means that you lacked commitment. So how do we strengthen that commitment for the rest of us that are married? How do we do that? We do it by making daily relational deposits. When we're investing money, we know that we have to continually add money to that account so that it will grow and so that things can happen with that. And as we do that over time, it leads to long-term dividends. I love Northgate. I love being a pastor. I want to retire at a certain point, though. So we put a good amount of our income into retirement accounts. We make those deposits over and over with an eye on what's going to happen long-term in the future, because we know by doing that now, it will get us to where we want to be in the future. And that's not just true in investing, it's true in marriage. It's true in my marriage, and it's true in yours. So we have to do important things, things like have fun together. So many couples lose sight of having fun together. You probably had fun together when you were dating, or you wouldn't have gotten married, just a guess. And when I see couples that have fun together, that enjoy being together, I encourage them to not lose that, because there will be a time down the road where, like, you've got this brand new beautiful area rug, and a baby will poop all over it, and you can either lose your mind, or you can laugh and start cleaning it up, and you can have fun together. I've had some of those moments, man. Kids do the craziest things, man. Kids are the reason why we can't have nice things. They're nice, but they're like the last nice thing we're going to own until they're all like 20. So do things like have fun together and share life together. Enjoy talking together, telling each other not just about what happened in your day or what you had for lunch, but talking to each other about what's going on inside, your hopes and your dreams, and how things are evolving and changing in your mind and in your life. And a big part of that is date each other. Continue to date each other. I know that a lot of you have heard that before, but particularly to parents that have young children, if you're in my kind of stage of life, I see so many parents who the marriage is going well and they have kids and they just become like roommates. They become mom and dad. There's no more like us. It's the kids, and it's all evolved around the kids, and everything's really important with the kids. And it just, they become mom and dad, and they lose sight of the husband and wife, the people that they married. I tell my girls this regularly, and particularly Grace, my oldest, doesn't love it because she doesn't want to finish second in anything. But I tell my girls, I love you more than you'll ever understand. Like, until you have your own kids, you will not know how much I love you. But I love your mom the most. I want them to know that so clearly, because, and when they've pushed me on this, I've tried to explain it. So if this is like a sitcom, if our life is a TV show, sometimes it feels like a sitcom, Amy and I are the main characters. It was me and Amy. We got married. We were the main characters. We, in a moment of weakness, decided to invite all these little characters in, and they're beautiful, and they're wonderful, and they're funny. But we had a really good thing going. So we have these kids, right? And they're here for 18 to 20 years in our house, something to that effect. Hopefully, we're, you know, kick them out of the nest when they can fly. And so then they're all going to leave. Some of you are in this stage of life. They're all going to leave. And what I don't want to happen at that point is to look back at Amy, who was originally, it was us back here, and be like, wait, where'd all these kids go? Why? Because we are the main characters of our family story. If you are married, I'm not telling you don't value your kids. I'm not saying your kids don't matter. But I'm telling you the best thing that you can do for your kids is to love your spouse well, to invest in that relationship. And my kids, they come and go on it a little bit. Kinsley the other day was like, oh no, Grace, look away. They're going to true love kiss. I'm like, that's right. That's right, man. That's not just in the Disney movies. We have to make the kind of investments that show the endless commitment that we have. And you show that to your spouse, you show it to yourself, and you show it to your kids too. As a church, we have to be a place that cares for marriages. We have to be a place that speaks about them and that speaks into them. We have got to be a place where people can admit that they need help before it's too late. I think that's really important. We've got to be the kind of church where you can say to your pastors, you can say to Pastor Vern, Pastor Marcia, myself, you can say, we need to sit down and talk. I tell couples when we're going through pre-marriage counseling, because we do that, there's three of us there. Sometimes there's four. Sometimes Amy does it, where I say, don't ever close the door to bringing a third party in to discuss stuff, to maybe help you get stuff moving. Don't ever be too proud to say, we need somebody to talk to. Don't wait until it's too late to do that. And we need to be the kind of church that will do that. A lot of times when I have couples come and sit down with me, they've been married and they're like, hey, can we come sit down with you and talk to you? There's a couple different things that happen. Most of the time I see two people that are saying, we really want to work on this marriage. Can you help us? Sometimes, though, I will see couples come in and one or both of them I've checked out and they're done and they're coming in so that a pastor can tell them, I give you, it's okay by me if you have a divorce. Like, I've got that kind of authority. And I see that and I'm always thinking, why didn't you come here sooner? Why didn't you come before one or both of you were checked out to say, we're struggling, we need help, this is not going how it's supposed to go. This is the kind of place where you can do that. We have to be a place where we know where to look for answers. And that's because our takeaway today is that the God who created marriage, he shows us how to make it work. He created marriage, he put this beautiful relationship in place, and then he showed us how to do it. He gave us relationships, he created them. God is an inherently relational being. He has got to be. I mean, think about it. God has got to be an extrovert, because if he wasn't, he wouldn't have created all of us. He had a pretty good thing going, right? It's dark, it's quiet, he's by himself, like, it sounds pretty good. I was just at Disney World for a week, and I'm an extrovert, and like day three or four, I was like, Amy, I'm going to the woods, and I don't want to see a living soul for a week. And God kind of had that situation, right? He didn't have to make us, but he did because he's a relational being, and he created us to be in a relationship with him, and he created us to be in relationships with each other, and he didn't just make that. He showed us how to make them work. Now, we're going to pray in a minute, but before we do, I want to ask people, if you're getting baptized now and you need to go get ready, now is a good time to do that. But when we pray together, I want to give you this encouragement, this challenge. If you are married and you're here with your spouse today, I want to encourage you to take their hand while we pray. And there's a few different things. Some of you guys, some of you have these marriages that the rest of us look at as like a hopeful thing of you've been married 25, 35, 40 more years, and you give the rest of us hope that that can be done, that we can live this well, we can do it together, and we can have the kind of marriage that you do. So as you take your spouse's hand, I encourage you just to say, God, just continue to give us the strength to live this life well, to be married well, to have that endless commitment. For other people, if you're earlier on and you're going through marriage and you're trying to figure this all out, I encourage you to take your spouse's hand as just a way to say, this is it. It's you and me forever. We're going to do this. We're going to have this endless commitment. We're going to be that kind of couple that in, you know, 40, 50 years, we go out to movies and dates and we make people kind of queasy in a really cute way. And we're like the schmoopy in love older couple. That's going to be us. And as you take each other's hands, that's what you're saying. But there's also people here who have not held hands in a while. You haven't done that. Maybe this is the only time you sit this close during an entire week. Maybe you came in and your marriage is just barely hanging on and you've been cautious, you've been hesitant to ask for help. I want you to take your spouse's hand in a moment of saying, I am not going to give up on you and I am not going to give up on us. I'm not going to give up on this. And we're going to do this together. We're going to get the help that we need. We're going to take the steps that we need to take. We're going to listen to God's plan for our relationship so that we can save this before it's too late. By God's grace. So I encourage you all as we pray to take each other's hands. Father God, for the marriages all over this room, Lord, I ask and pray that your grace would just fill them in a supernatural way, Lord, in a way that none of us could do on our own. That God, you would give us the strength to love each other well. Lord, you'd give us the commitment to work hard in marriage. Lord, that you would show us how to make our marriages work, Lord, so that you would be glorified through that. So that Northgate would stand as a place of strong marriages that loves marriages, cares for them, speaks into them, encourages them, and by that, we can do that in the world around us. So Lord, I ask and pray for each of the couples now that are holding hands, Lord, that you would encourage them to take the steps that they need to either continue their marriage on in a strong way or to strengthen it in a new way. God, that the people that have steps they need to take, whether it's asking for help, whether it's opening up their phones to each other, whatever it is, God, a conversation that needs to be had, forgiveness that needs to be given, that God, you would give them the wisdom to know what to do and the courage to do it. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for joining us on the Northgate Podcast. We hope this message has been a blessing to you as you walk with Jesus Christ. For more resources, visit our website at northgatefmc.com or download the Northgate app. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time.